Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Emily Epstein Landau, the author of Spectacular Wickedness, Sex, Race, and Memory in Storyville, New Orleans. Yuka Patz will give us a taste of the upcoming book festival, and Rita Lagansky talks about her new novel, The Silence of Bonaventure Arrow. My guest today is Emily Epstein Landau, who teaches in the Department of History at the University of Maryland at College Park. She's with us to talk about her fascinating new book, Spectacular Wickedness, Sex, Race, and Memory in Storyville, New Orleans. Welcome to The Reading Life, Emily.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
What a book! Now, this began during your graduate study at Yale University when a professor directed you to Storyville. And then you discovered the blue books in the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Tell us about that moment when you first saw those blue books.
Well, I had no knowledge about New Orleans really at all. I'll just say right off the bat, I was not a place that I was particularly interested in. And when this professor of mine suggested that I look at Storyville, it was so that I could actually get something done during the semester. I had to do research. And I started looking at these guidebooks, which, I mean, luckily Yale has a very wonderful library, and we happened to have some of these extremely rare guidebooks. And first I thought, how strange that a red light district would have a guidebook in the first place. And I was looking through it, and I saw that it was kind of organized according to a rubric in which the women were categorized according to race. And so there were white women, and there were colored women, and there were octoroon women. And I thought, that's odd. Why would that be a category kind of desire in the South at the turn of the century after the Plessy v. Ferguson decision? And so that question of why were there octoroons in Storyville being advertised really drove me to explore further.
I've only seen one blue book. I've only held one in my hands. And there is something so stunning about this guidebook to a district of prostitution that advertises services. They're really kind of amazing to see. And in the course of your research, you got a grant to have the blue books at the Historic New Orleans Collection microfilmed so others can use them. And that was certainly generous of you.
Well, it was a very wonderful grant from the Social Science Research Council, their Sexuality Fellowship Research Program. And I think because it's really more scientifically based, there was a specific amount of money set aside for equipment, but I didn't need any equipment. And I thought, oh, well, why don't we do this? Because the books were getting very frail and very restricted in their use. And I thought, well, that's too bad. And so now they're available on microfilm.
Well, your book has one of those straight out opening lines, which is, this is a book about sex. So there, here comes the reader right after you, you know. So how did you get involved in this area of research?
It really was this desire that began in studying slavery in this class with David Brian Davis, a very eminent scholar of slavery. And in some of the readings, we learned that free women of color worked in cities as prostitutes. This was one of the jobs that women of color could get, while enslaved women of color were routinely or systematically sexually abused and raped. And I thought, what if we explore the relationship between these two things, prostitution and slavery, as ways in which women are oppressed through sex and race? And that's really how I became interested in the topic, really to study gender and sexuality and race and commerce and how they all work together at different periods in American history.
One woman in particular really captured your attention, and that is Lulu White. What a complicated character she is. I wonder if you'd describe her a little bit, because she did so many outrageous and fascinating things.
Lulu White was the most notorious madam not just I who was fascinated by her. She's singled out repeatedly in the primary source literature describing Storyville and describing her. And she's this woman who has some important and powerful connections in the city that allow her to build this terrific mansion, which she calls Mahogany Hall. And mahogany is a dark wood from the hot regions of the world. It's a tropical wood. It's exotic. And her main commodity, shall we say, that she marketed at this great Mahogany Hall was octoroon women. And she herself claimed to be an octoroon. She claimed to be from the West Indies. And even as she's claiming to be from the West Indies, she's also claiming not to have one drop of colored blood. And so she's playing on all of these associations and stereotypes and sexual identities that have developed over years and years and years in order to run a bordello in Storyville. One of the reasons she stands out is that she has her own souvenir guidebook, which is also at the Beinecke Library. So it's one of the first things I was able to see that specifically describes Mahogany Hall and gives an introduction of herself to the reader. And it has little pictures of the women who are working in Mahogany Hall. And they all look to a modern day eye to be white. And so she's kind of created this marketing niche where these women are kind of passing, in a sense, as octoroons, and she's kind of raking in the money by marketing them that way. She herself was from Alabama. Her mother was a woman of color. Her father was white. She didn't have any of that historical New Orleans, West Indian heritage at all. She just made it all up.
One of the things that permeates this book that's been so interesting to you is this myth of the tragic octoroon.
Well, the tragic octoroon, it really emerges in abolitionist literature around the 1830s when the abolitionists seize on the moral decrepitude of slavery and the hypocrisy of slavery and the way that slavery affects the family and particularly affects women. And the tragic octoroon is a figure in these plays and poems and novels. She's a young girl. She's exceedingly beautiful. She looks white. And, you know, we're dealing in a time period when even the abolitionists had racist sensibilities about the superiority of the white race. So she's supposed to have all the attributes of an upper middle class white young woman. Extremely good manners, extremely well-formed, very beautiful, totally innocent and pure, and yet she's a slave. And the stories turn on a kind of tragic reversal of fortune where her father, the master, has neglected to free her and has died, and so she's put up on the auction block with the rest of the slaves in the family, and it's always either explicit or implied that she's going to be sold, often in New Orleans, as a sexual slave, as a concubine to a white master. And so the tragedy is not the unremitting servitude of slavery or even chattel slavery more generally. It's this reversal of fortune that wherein a white or nearly white woman becomes a sex slave. And this was something that resonated with upper middle class and middle class women in America, in the North, and in England. And it kind of gave new vitality to the abolitionist movement. Harriet Beecher Stowe's wonderful classic work, Uncle Tom's Cabin, features, you know, Eliza is a kind of a tragic quadroon figure. So these were very common and well-understood figures in America.
Well, one of the things I love is the way you write about New Orleans with such great passion and such an understanding of the city. I love especially the story of the unexpected dance hall, which exists right next door to a Door of Hope mission for fallen women. And how like New Orleans to have those two things side by side. We've been talking with Emily Epstein Landau, the author of Spectacular Wickedness, Sex, Race, and Memory in Storyville, New Orleans. Thanks so much, Emily.
Thank you.
book artist Yuka Petz is returning to the Reading Life to talk about the Edible Book Festival, an international festival that takes place every April. Here in New Orleans, it will be at the Alvar Library Garden, April 6, from 1 to 4. The artist group SIFT, that stands for Sequence, Image, Form, and Text, partners with the Alvar Library to present this event. Yuka is one of its co-founders. Hi, Yuka.
Hi, Susan.
So, what's an edible book?
An edible book is anything bookish that is made from all edible materials. So it could be actually in the structure of a book. It could be a cake that's sort of a pun on a title or playing off of any literary character or any story. The sky's the limit as long as there's some bookish element to it, and it's all edible materials.
Yum.
Super yum.
I can't wait. So tell us what categories you're opening at the Edible Book Festival.
Well, the Edible Book Festival is open to every participant, all ages. We have four prize categories that we award based on community voting. And the categories are Novel Eats, which is the most inspired use of literature or literary reference. There's the Cooked Book, which is rewarded for the best use or exploration of a book-like structure. There's Bound for Greatness, which is best in show for 12 and under. And then there's the Upper Crust, which is best in show for adults.
I love it. So tell about the Bound for Greatness entries you've gotten last year.
Well, last year our Bound for Greatness entries included a super fun, Very Hungry Caterpillar, which was actually two platters of a baked caterpillar with these lollipop, I guess they're antennae, and it had the plates of food with holes in it all over the place. We had a really fun cake about the book Circles. And this year we're really excited to have even more entrants for our 12 and under. We have a number of fun activities on site throughout the event, including a paper puppet making activity where we make the white rabbit and the clock from Alice in Wonderland. And this year also Whole Foods is donating a number of cookies for us to have a decorating station for kids to decorate their own cookies.
Oh, what fun.
Super fun.
Now, one of the cakes I saw on the website was the Infinite Zest, which I thought was such a clever pun.
It was great. Savannah made the Infinite Zest for us last year, and it was just a beautiful, clean, simple, perfect pun on infinite jest.
And it was a beautiful cake with a lot of citrus zest in an infinity sign on top, which I thought was just simple and beautiful and clever, you know?
It was great.
Now, what was the most unusual entry you got last year?
That's tricky because I think one of the fun parts about the Edible Book Festival for us was that everyone was so creative and took it so many ways. So we had lots of puns. We had people who made cakes more relating to book covers. Like there was a beautiful Alice in Wonderland book cover. We had The Joint actually sort of snuck an entry in. They did Heart of Carcass, and it was this bread with just leftover meats, and they we didn't even see them come in. They just came and snuck it in there, and it was a big hit. One of the other great entrants last year was Love in the Time of Cauliflower, and that's Time, T-H-Y-M-E, and she actually won the Structure Award, and it was beautiful. It was a head of cauliflower that she had cut in half, and she found those really beautiful red and white beets that are kind of heart-shaped when you slice them, and so those were the pages. The cauliflower was the book cover. I mean, it was just perfect. It was a really great play on words, but also using food and the books.
Now, where can people go to find pictures of some of the entries for inspiration?
Yeah, there's a number of places. You can go to the SIFT website, siftart.org, and we have photos of last year's event at the Alvar Library. But you can also look at www.books2eat.com, and that's two, the numeral two. And that's actually the international archive for all of the edible book entries from around the world. And this festival happens all around the world around the beginning of April.
So what do you think making an edible book adds to a person's reading life?
I think making an edible book allows you to really dive into your favorite books or your favorite characters or even your favorite book structures in a way that you maybe hadn't thought about before.
So give us the details of the Edible Book Festival.
The Edible Book Festival is going to be held on Saturday, April 6th at the Alvar Library Garden on Alvar Street in the Bywater. The event runs from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We have a registration period from 1 to 2, and we ask you to bring your entries then so that we can set them all up for community judging. We actually have a special gift for the first 20 entrants this year, which is a little bit of a secret, but we're pretty excited about. And then we open up community judging from 2:30 to 3, and this is really such a fun part of our event where everyone who comes gets to vote on all of the categories. And then at 3 o'clock, we announce awards, and then we begin eating everything, and that's really maybe the highlight of the day is digging into all of the different edible books that we've been looking at and sort of getting excited about.
I love the idea. Eat your favorite book. I think it'll be a lot of fun. You were talking earlier about the one that was not edible for humans that you got last year.
Yes, we had an entry last year, which was actually a beautiful entry, but it was made of wood that had been eaten by termites. And it actually looked like a book from the side, the way the termites had eaten the wood looked like pages. And, you know, we never specified that it had to be edible for humans. And so we had a very push the limits entry, which was great.
I love it. I love the whole idea. So think hard about what book you'd like to read and eat at the Edible Book Festival. And come on out and see Yuka on Saturday, April 6th at the Alvar Library Garden. That's at 913 Alvar Street. Thanks so much.
Thank you. We hope to see you there.
You bet. Rita Luganski is making her debut with the New Orleans novel, The Silence of Bonaventure Arrow. It's set in New Orleans in the 1920s through the 1950s, the story of an exceptional little boy who doesn't speak, but who hears everything in this world and voices from another, as well as the adults who people his life. We're talking with Rita about how this northern girl developed a lifelong fascination with the South. Hi, Rita.
Hello.
Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, you're one of those writers who fell in love with place and story by reading and reading in childhood. So how did this northern girl fall in love with the South?
Well, you know, imagine the landscape that I was in, especially in the winters. Just snow everywhere, and where I'm from, it's very flat, which is a beauty of its own. But to leave that and read these descriptions of, you know, you could smell the flowers and just about feel the heavy air and the greenness and the lushness everywhere. And it just seemed to have something to do with the characters as well. For me, it was always like being enchanted.
Now, it's interesting. Your life interests me because you waited till your children were grown to go back to school and really study your craft. So you'd lived some life before you turned to writing.
I did, and in my case, I think it was the very best thing that could have happened. It does change you, you know, especially when you're writing about children, if you've had children yourself. But I think, too, you gain some experience, you know, at just what it is to be human. And when you're writing a book like Bonaventure Arrow, which is about the human condition, it just helps you feel it that much more.
And it's such an old-fashioned kind of enveloping story. It's very long and it's very involving and satisfying, and yet it grew from a short story.
Well, it was not only my very last class in graduate school, but my very last assignment. And the professor said, you know what, guys, give me something different. So I thought, well, you know, I'll try my hand at magical realism. Where this little guy came from, I have no idea. I sat down and I typed out the title. And actually, that short story, which was 13 pages long by the time I'd finished, did find its way into the novel, but well into the novel. I knew that I would have this little boy who was otherworldly. And I felt that the best way to accomplish that was to sort of tamper with one of his senses. Because knowing that when one sense is weakened, other senses become stronger. I just felt it was going to be a very good way to have him be gifted and find a way into other people's lives.
And he's a remarkable little boy who doesn't speak, but who hears everything. So what did that do for you as a writer and a listener? One of the things I'm struck by are the wonderful descriptions in this book of sounds and the sounds he treasures.
You know, it did make me a better listener. I became more aware because I had to make a conscious effort to look at something and think, does it make a sound? If it did make a sound, what would it be like? Well, hearing sounds kind of command you to use your other senses because sounds, they have no shape, you know, unless they're being measured with some sort of machine and wavelength or something. You have to imagine them and give them some sort of shape and give them some sort of color or personify them. So once I had that in my head, and it was almost like an exercise I would do and look at something and think, well, what sort of noise would that make? But it did force me to use all of my senses, I think. You know, I'd look around a room and see if there was something else in the room that might relate to the object I was talking about. Now, Bonaventure hears not only the sounds of objects, but what is behind that sound. He hears the anger or the love or the sorrow that's behind it. So that was something that I had to really connect to him, and that's how he became so supernatural to me.
And this is a novel that's about, you know, those great subjects of loss and healing, because the great task of one of the characters is to assuage the grief of others and to move on. That's a really lovely metaphor for that, you know, the whole loss of the human voice. It was really well done. Now, it seems to me that New Orleans is a city that's kind of ripe for magical realism. How did you find that?
You know, it wasn't even close. Nothing else compares to New Orleans. You can't get more magically real than that city. I love it. It's a city kind of opposites. It excites the senses. It's so colorful. I think I chose from New Orleans the word jambalaya because that's what it really is. It's this mix of all these cultures into like a spicy filet gumbo, you know. It's like its own food and music. It's part African and Caribbean, Cajun, European. And it's just so alive. And there was so much there for Bonaventure to hear. Now, many of the events take place in New Orleans. And then I came up with the fictional Bayou-Cymbeline very nearby, close enough to be kind of under that spell, but with a purity all its own. But New Orleans, you know, to me, it celebrates what it is to be human.
Now, New Orleans can be a harsh mistress, though, when it comes to setting fiction here. It does.
Yes.
One of the things I love is that you say you can't forget a name like Chapatulis, and you spell it correctly. Thank you very much. And you said you came here to do confirming research. Was
yes.
that your first time to come to New Orleans?
It was.
So you had created this whole fictional city and then came to test it out.
I did. And, you know, the research I did for Bonaventure Arrow, though it's fiction, I wanted it to be as true as I could make it. And so the sources I used would be accounts written by people who had actually experienced what I was talking about, things that I could access in, you know, the Library of Congress, sort of what you would say peer-reviewed sources. And so I was able to do so much. But I knew that's only going to take you so far. You then have to go and put your finger on the pulse of this city and walk it myself. I had to see what my characters saw. It was wonderful when I went there. I was able to see things my characters would have seen, Mardi Gras tickets from the 1920s, menus that maybe William and Dancy would have looked at the Hotel Monte Leon. This is a great story. I was so sure that the Wanderer had arrived in New Orleans on the Great Southern Railway. And because my research told me so, But I thought, you know, I want to be so exact with all of this. So I talked to the historian at the Hotel Monte Leon, a Southern gentleman to his core. He was, I think, 81. His name was Charlie Ferret. And I said, Charlie, I have an important character coming to New Orleans and arriving on the Great Southern Railway. And he said, why no, darling? That would have been the Panama Limited. Leave Chicago at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, arrive New Orleans, 9:30 next morning, there would have been a glorious breakfast. And that's why I came to New Orleans, to get that feeling, and that even the Library of Congress isn't going to give me that. When I was there, I just kind of soaked it up.
As everybody does. And it'll be so much fun for you to come back book in hand now.
I can't wait.
Oh, well, we've been talking with Rita Lagansky, whose lovely first novel is The Silence of Bonaventure Arrow. You can meet her April 8th, that's Monday, April 8th, at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Rita, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Sally Newhart signs her book, The Original Tuxedo Jazz Band, Tuesday, March 26th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Photographer Theron Humphrey and Maddie the Coonhound come to Octavia Books to sign their debut book, Maddie on Things, Tuesday, March 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Katarina Boudreau and Maurice Ruffin read Thursday, March 28th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. That's part of the 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. Diane de las Casas, author of The Little Red Hen, and Kit Chef Eliana, author of Cool Kids Cook, appears Saturday, March 30th from 11:30 to 1 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Latoya Easter signs Can't Cry, Saturday, March 30th at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. Novelist Nathaniel Rich signs Odds Against Tomorrow, Thursday, April 4th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The New Orleans Museum of Art and Cafe Noma by Ralph Brennan are celebrating Edible Book Day, a cake baking and decorating contest. That's at Noma, Friday, April 5th. Design and bake and decorate a cake inspired by your favorite book and bring it to Noma Friday, April 5th to be judged by a panel of celebrity judges. No fee to enter. Categories include funniest, punniest, best visual presentation, most creative, most like a book, as well as special professional categories for people who bake for a living. For more information, contact Sheila Cork, the librarian at New Orleans Museum of Art. That's scork@noma.org or 504-658-4117. You can meet today's guest, Yuka Petz, Saturday, April 6th from 1 to 4 at the Edible Book Festival at the Alvar Library Garden, 913 Alvar Street. Don't forget to bring a donation for the Second Harvest Food Bank. And Gina Ferrara is putting together Poets Reading Poets. Many New Orleans poets will read a poem by their favorite poet. And that takes place Saturday, April 6th at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.